This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, bringing you the Virginia Piedmont Technology Council's January Luncheon, Beyond the Book, Using Technology to Enhance K-12 Learning. The program was sponsored by the University of Virginia and was introduced by VPTC Vice Chair Gary Henry.
I'd like to introduce a representative from our sponsor, UVA, Glenn Bull, who's the professor of who is a professor of education at the Curry School and co-director of the Curry Center for Technology and Teacher Education, who will introduce our panel. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you for inviting us to have a panel focused on technology in schools. My understanding is that we have about 75 teachers who have come today, and I think that's some indication of the strong interest in this area. In the 1980s, the Curry School of Education worked with the Virginia Department of Education to develop the nation's first statewide K-12 internet system that linked all 2,000s of Virginia schools. But once we had them all connected, the question was, how can that result in improvement in student learning and achievement? Well, we have a couple of great examples this afternoon that will focus on two areas, on the humanities, English and social studies, and on math and science. So you'll be, I think, getting a really good look at how this can best change how schooling occurs. We have been very fortunate to have, in this area, a very innovative firm, Explore Learning. In Truth in Advertising, I have to mention that my colleague, Joe Garofalo, who is the director of the Curry Technology Center, at one time taught one of the founders of Explore Learning and sits on their board. So we do have some connection there and are not totally unbiased. Having said that, I have to say that this is the kind of innovation that is going to change how learning takes place, we believe. Michael Lasko, the moderator, is director of business development for ProQuest Information and Learning Company, where he's responsible for identifying new opportunities to spur business growth through mergers, acquisitions, and strategic alliances. Michael joined ProQuest through its February 2005 acquisition of Explore Learning, where he was chief operating officer for 5 years. Prior to that time, Michael worked at LexisNexis in Charlottesville and practiced corporate law in New York and holds a JD and BA from the University of Virginia. Paul from Chomsky, who is currently with Explore Learning, joined them in 1991. He is not from Charlottesville, but comes from Montreal, Canada, and earned an MA in Educational Technology from Concordia University. He's the author of an undergraduate text on statistical analysis, but he also is one of the folks that developed what they call gizmos at Explore Learning. And you'll get a chance to learn more about that as they explore how this can change how we think about teaching and learning in math and science. In the area of English and social studies, we have two folks here. Bill Furster is in a second career. In his first career, he worked in the area of film and television industry, and in the early 90s was the developer of the first digital video editor ever, and as a result of that innovation, received an Emmy Award. Now, granted that companies are apt to engage in hyperbole, but I love the inscription that the firm that he founded, the Publicitas, created an inscription, and it said, "So the Emmy was awarded for an innovation that forever changed the film and television industry." Now, even granted that that may be a bit of hyperbole, nevertheless, you have to say that any time you do the first of something, it's significant. Currently, Bell is trying to see how these same technologies might be used to leverage teaching history in English. He's working with Terry Levinson, who is a teacher at Broadus-Wood Elementary. Terry came to the Curry School and took a course last year on digital storytelling. And she was so engaged that we asked her if she would work with us to pilot the innovation that she and Bill are going to describe. Bill will tell you about how it works from a technical perspective, and Terry will tell you a little bit about how it worked in an actual pilot in her classroom. So I think you'll find this very interesting in terms of seeing how we can leverage the new capabilities of the web to change learning in schools. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Glenn, for that rousing introduction. I didn't know this was going to be an Emmy award-winning panel, but I'm pleased to be moderating it this afternoon. I would like to add my thanks already to Gary's, to UVA, for sponsoring today's event and enabling the attendance of so many teachers and other school personnel. I also want to thank my company, ProQuest Information and Learning, for being our technology sponsor and enabling our T1 Internet access today. Especially, I want to thank all of you for attending this afternoon, especially teachers and school personnel. If you haven't already done so, if you'd switch your cell phones to vibrate, we'd all appreciate that. My role as moderator this afternoon will be to keep a close watch on time so that we can make sure to see all of the interesting presentations we have, and also ensure that there's some time at the close of the discussion for some Q&A from you in the audience. Today's panel is going to focus specifically on applications, as we've said, for the K-12 classroom, math, science, social studies, and English. We have a premise, and that is this: the best educational technology for classroom use is teacher-supportive. It doesn't really supplant the important role of a teacher. This is not self-driven software. It is not; these products are not tutorial in their role. They can be used in different settings, in front of a group using a projector or a smart board, in a lab setting, or individual in the classroom one-on-one or even at home. They're easy to use and integrate from a technology perspective, and that means bandwidth and plugins and all of those usual headaches that we have encountered here this morning. And also that these products can work with a variety of students and learning styles, from at-risk students to advanced learners. So having said all that, I think it's time to get going. So first up will be Paul Chomsky to talk about Explore Learning.
Just to give you a quick background of what Explore Learning is and what gizmos are, and then we'll plunge into the good stuff. We're a local Charlottesville company. We're right down on the downtown mall here, just a few steps away. Started in 1999, went through the internet boom, went through the internet bust, and then happily for us, we were acquired by ProQuest last year, which is a great thing because it's giving us the resources to bring gizmos to more people. So what are gizmos? What is this good thing that we're bringing to more people? Highly interactive online simulations for math and science targeted at grades 6 through 12. And I want to amplify a point that Michael made, which was that these are very expressly, it's supplementary content. It's not courseware. It's not the kind of thing that you sit a student in front of and then sort of walk away. But it's designed to amplify your role, to be a tool for you to use to stimulate discussions with your students. There's a way for them to be used in a one-on-one context, but it's not sort of a page turner that locks you into a specific teaching style or even pushes you out of the picture entirely. And what we have is a website called explorelearning.com. It's a library right now that has over 400 gizmos, and it's growing at the rate of about 40-50 gizmos a year. It's correlated to state, national standards, major textbooks. So at this rate, if we don't have the specific teaching objective that you're looking to cover in math or science right now, we'll have it soon. Drop us an email or walk down the mall and let us know what you want to see. That's explorelearning.com. In terms of where we are, some of the nation's largest school districts, Los Angeles, LA Unified, Miami, Boston, Atlanta. We have a little bit in New York City now as well. Here in Virginia, we have relations with Albemarle, Rockingham, Rockbridge, Alexandria, and Ryko and Norfolk, just to give you an idea of who's using gizmos right now. Instead of sort of standing up here and talking to you about, in sort of generic philosophical terms, about the way we see gizmos being used in the classroom, what I did was I pulled actual case studies from our website. And if you go to explorelearning.com, there's a case studies section where you'll see some local teachers as well as teachers from across the nation talking about the way that they use gizmos in their classroom. So I just grabbed three that I thought would be interesting for the crowd today. And we're going to start off with Nora Rainbow from Addington High School. Now, just to give you sort of a pedagogical context, I know we've got some teachers here and probably some math teachers and probably some other people for whom algebra is a very distant memory, so I'll try to do this in sort of generic terms. What Honora is pedagogical issues were, she's teaching slope and y-intercept, which are things when you're graphing lines, the slope is the angle that the line sort of looks on the graph, and y-intercept is where it crosses the y-axis. She's trying to get these concepts across to students. You've got to remember that in some ways this is an uphill battle with kids. There was a study just about 5 years ago in a large suburban high school that was looking at how many students understood that a point on a graph was a solution to the equation that the graph was of, and it was less than 50%. So they're really struggling with a lot of these issues, which seem sort of commonsensical to people who understand them. And she wants to move beyond this mechanics of writing and graphing equations. If a student works hard enough, the teacher does their job, students will start learning how to solve an equation sort of as a rote recipe, but is the understanding there? Is it something that's going to stick in their heads? So she wanted something that's going to link slope and y-intercept and other sort of abstract topics to real-world examples of some kind, to scenarios that the students are going to understand. She also wanted them, that's the second point, to see what it meant. There's a sort of mantra that you've hit in Algebra 1, that the solution of a system of equations represents the point where two lines intersect. What does that mean? What is this mantra? So students dutifully try to memorize this, but what does it mean? Well, we have a gizmo that helps. And that's the one that she likes. It's called modeling linear systems. So right now what I'm going to jump over to is... what I'm doing right now is logging in explorelearning.com. What you're seeing over here is at the bottom there's a cat and a mouse. Okay, sort of a Tom and Jerry-like scenario. And you've got on the top right corner a graph where you have a blue line and a red line. The blue line corresponds to the mouse, who's in blue, and the red line corresponds to the cat, who's in red. And you've also got three sliders in the top left-hand corner, which control some parameters. Let's just press the simulate button to see what happens. Cat chases mouse. Oh! Does cat catch mouse? No. Mouse narrowly avoids becoming a lunch. Although if we wanted to tie this into current events, the mouse would be on fire and would be burning down the house, and the cat would be calling 911 to save the owner. Somebody at your table will be able to explain that reference. So what we have here is the ability to change using the red slider. Sorry, but let me drop that volume a little bit on you. So we can change the cat's average speed. So let's set him at, he's a very, very slow cat, maybe had too much from the buffet line. So now he's running very slowly. You see how the red line gets a little bit flatter. And if we had time to actually teach the lesson, we could talk about how, what's actually happening, why a change in average speed is causing the line to change slope on a distance time graph. But now the cat's running faster and faster. This point, this is the way Gizmo started. The cat's running at 5 feet per second. The mouse is running at 4 feet per second. So the cat is running faster than the mouse. The line is steeper. The red line is steeper than the blue line. Why doesn't the cat catch the mouse? Because the mouse has a head start. So now we have some kind of real-world meaning for the fact that the blue line isn't cutting through the origin. Another very common misconception students make when they're graphing is that the line always has to pass through the origin. But here we have a meaning for the y-intercept, that it's the mouse's head start. As the y-intercept, as the blue line moves up, the mouse gets a bigger head start. As we move the mouse back, he gets less of a head start. And if the cat runs fast enough, boom. Now, cat catches mouse, and we have very concrete meaning for the term where what happens when two lines intersect. So this is the one that this, it doesn't get into the actual equations. There's no equations on screen. There is a data table that you can access if you want to start getting at a pointwise interpretation of the function. But we're not into the equations yet. We have a suite of gizmos that looks at systems of linear equations. This is sort of the introductory one. And we like it when teachers use this in this fashion. They just give you a real-world scenario that's hopefully memorable, that the students get to get into. They have something to hang the concept of slope and y-intercept onto. And then you get into the equations. And then it's a different game than starting off with number crunching and hoping that some kind of mystical understanding emerges. So that's the one that Honora was talking about. Let's go back to Honora and see what she had to say about that. So modeling linear systems gizmo gave the students a good opportunity to see the relevance of slope and y-intercept as speed and starting points and giving some kind of meaning to the point of intersection. In this case, it was where the cat caught the mouse. It was fun. This is hopefully a theme that you will see throughout this presentation, that this gives you also an opportunity to give the kids something to do that's different than just plugging values into equations and so forth, that kids actually enjoy using the gizmos. In addition to the case studies on our site, there's a whole bunch of testimonials, some of them from kids, and you can see the impact this has on the classroom in terms of the engagement level. In fact, maybe the next one will get at that a little bit too. This is Janet Kingsolver, from middle school science teacher from Oklahoma. And she's an interesting example. I think now Our sales doubled last year. We're starting really with the backing of ProQuest. We're being able to bring Gizmos to a lot more people. And so we're moving out of this sort of early adopter, tech champion user base to more teachers who are just looking for, you know, any kind of way, it doesn't have to be tech, to improve their instruction. So Janet's a good example because she came to Explore Learning sort of through an end run. Her sister was at a teacher's conference where we were giving away a free annual subscription, and I think she was a social studies teacher. Math and science simulations not really up her alley, but her sister's a middle school science teacher. Boom, Janet, here you go. Here's your free subscription. And just from the way she phrases her comments, it was fairly easy to get into, and the gizmos were interesting, but she was just kicking the tires. She just wanted to see what was there. But I keep using them because my students get excited about them each time they use them. They love them. They're challenged by them. I see my students studying relationships between things and concepts and getting excited about finding them. And I put in bold, my biggest problem is keeping my students from exploring the other gizmos I put on their class page. That's the kind of thing we want to hear. That's your biggest problem, Janet. We're doing our job. And she said she hasn't taught these topics in 15 years, so she's somebody who's coming back to teaching middle school science. This is a common thing in schools, obviously. Back then, I was only able to simulate density with water and clay balls. You know, that was K-12 education technology back then. It took forever and didn't work a lot. The ideal gas laws were simulated with role plays of people under pressure. So she had her students actually act out. Now, this is a nice cross-curricular drama meets science kind of lesson plan, so, you know, kudos on that role. But if the actors, you know, blow their lines, then maybe the science learning is going to take a bit of a hit. So let's take a look at what Janet is using in terms of ideal gas laws. So this is ideal gas laws. And again, I don't really have the time to teach a lesson in ideal gas laws, but I just wanted to give you sort of a science simulation example. So what you've got here, sorry again if it's a little wee in the back, is a little burner underneath gas molecules. And so this allows us to do one of two things. One, we can change the temperature at which we heat the gas and see what happens to the volume in the container. Or we can change the amount of mass that we put on the container lid, which is squishing down and changing the volume of the container. We want to see what happens to the pressure as a result. I'm going to do a real quick graph here. We can see that as we lower the temperature, that's probably really not visible to you guys in the back, but as I'm lowering the temperature, the intensity of the flame underneath, it's getting a little brighter. Now, as we increase the temperature, something's happening. The molecules are getting excited, and all of a sudden the container, it's getting larger because it's exerting more upward force. So students can see that on the bar chart. And then we go onto the graph, and we start collecting a little bit of data. And let's see what kind of relationship there is. Looks like we're getting some kind of a pattern here. And hopefully the students are seeing, oh, goodness gracious, if I actually drew a line through these points, I would get a linear relationship between the two, which just happens to be Charles' law. And if we had more time, then we'd start varying the mass that's on top of the container and seeing how that changed the relationship. Was it still linear, but did the slope change, that kind of thing? And then we go over to Boyle's law, and let's set a temperature, and now we're going to do the opposite kind of experiment. The sweet sound of clicking in the air. Okay, now we have a slightly different relationship here. It's A, it's an inverse relationship, and B, it's not linear anymore. There's a change in the rate at which, as I'm adding more mass to the top and squeezing down the gas, that there's a different relationship between volume and the pressure that you're applying. Okay, so that's Boyle's law. Now we go back to see what Janet had to say about that. In terms of how she's working, that's another thing I want to point out. Nora, in the first case study, was using it in the context that I'm actually using it right now, where she has one computer in her classroom, and she's using a desktop projector to push it up there, and she can ask what-if questions to the kids, like what if the lines are parallel, the cat and the mouse's lines are parallel, what does that mean in terms of what you're going to see in the animation, and show of hands, okay, let's see what actually happens. So that's that kind of context, which is a very common one. A lot of our customers use the gizmos in that way. Janet's a different one. She's going off to a lab where each kid is going to have access to a computer, although she does point out here that most of the students are working individually, though some end up working together, and almost all are discussing with someone else about their findings as they work. So you could even see, you know, two kids, three kids on a computer, that this would work in that context. Now, what's the teacher's role in all this? That's the second bullet point. I monitor their work, asking questions, putting ideas from one student out to the others, pushing them onto other possibilities, and of course, classroom management being what it is, keeping them working in an orderly manner through the exploration guide. And then after the gizmo's finished, we go back to class and review the findings, ask more questions, and so forth. So this is how we work in a lab context. And this is what we'll hear in summary from Janet. Initially, I didn't think I would have the kids explore relationships as much as I do. Remember, she sort of came to explore learning from the sisterly side route. But the ideal gas laws gizmo really showed the differences between Boyle's and Charles' laws. The kids liked changing the pressures and watching the graphs change. And I love this last point. They were very impressed by the straight and curved lines of the graphs and said they finally understood direct and inverse relationships from watching the graphs being built. Not only is Janet probably ecstatic over that line, but there's a math teacher across the hallway who's dancing a jig because that person has been trying to get that particular relationship through. And that was actually the reason why in 2003 when we started ExploreLearning.com, before that we used to segment our math and science gizmos with textbooks and so forth. But then we thought, you know what? There's so many opportunities for a math teacher to use a science gizmo to demonstrate the real-world application of a math concept. And vice versa, science teachers, they're going to need some of the math gizmos before they get into kinematics or whatever it's going to be that they're going to be teaching. Let's just put them all together. That's why now we have this growing library of 400 gizmos. Then math and science, if you get a subscription, everybody can go in there and you'll find a lot of cross-curricular applications. Maybe not with the drama department, but at least between math and science. So let me just do a quick time check here. Okay, we're still doing okay. Now we have, this is the last case study that I'll look at. This is Ann Gill from St. Paul's Episcopal. I wanted to bring up something that's a little bit more complex in terms of topical focus, but also that shows what's the thing that I think is really cool about gizmos is that in your math classroom, they give you an opportunity to teach and hands-on explore concepts the same way that the science teacher can. In this case, what Anne was talking about is when you graph a feasible region by hand, it's not possible to plug in every value to the objective function. The kids do not have the ability to prove the theorem that states the maximum and minimum will occur at the vertices of the feasible region. Students must take this on faith, which I do not believe is an effective teaching practice. I agree with you, Anne. Now, the problem is, you know, for many of you who are not au courant right now with linear programming, right off the tips of your fingers, that was probably a fairly complex paragraph. And for most students in Algebra 2, or even Algebra 1, that's a very complex paragraph. So let's take a look at what Anne's talking about. We're going to go to the gizmo linear programming. Linear programming is basically the combination of two ideas. One, a system of constraints, and two, something that you're trying to optimize on. Really toy example. Let's say you're a craftsperson and your thing as a side enterprise is to make stuffed cats and stuffed mice. And you want to sell them at a flea market. And because the cats are bigger, it takes 2 hours to make one, and it takes 1 hour to make a stuffed mouse. So you have 10 hours in your copious amounts of spare time when you're not being a teacher, and so you can make 5 cats, or you can make 10 mice, or you can make some kind of combination because that's just the amount of time you have. And maybe there's another constraint. Maybe cats and mice require different amounts of materials, so you can only make X amount of cats or Y amount of mice, and you have to juggle all of these constraints. Well, that's what linear programming is all about, is giving you a systematic way of modeling using linear equations a set of constraints on what you can do, and that's that shaded area in between. Wouldn't be a good one for the cat and mouse example, but you know, bear with me. So that triangle, all the values within that shaded area represent viable or feasible solutions to the set of constraints that you're working with. But then on top of that, you want to make some money. So that's your objective or profit function. If you sell cats, let's say, at $3 a cat, I don't know what the going rate is for stuffed mice, but let's say it's $1.50, then you have to model that because that's your profit. If you sell 10 mice and 3 cats, boom, you get one kind of profit. If you sell 20 mice and 1 cat, you get another kind of profit. So your job is to figure out, okay, within this whole feasible region of possibilities, what is the single best product mix in order for me to make the most amount of money? And that you model by this equation up here. Now, again, we would take a number of lessons if we were actually wanted to go into depth. One of the nice things about this gizmo, though, is that it allows the teacher to very easily, while she's talking about real-world applications, let's see if I can get a better mouse performance. Ah, there we go. To very quickly change the kinds of equations she's dealing with, add more. I'm hoping there's some teachers who deal with linear programming out there who are going, wow, that's cool. I really wish I had that when I was teaching linear programming. You can quickly change shapes, and that's a great way just to explore some of those foundational concepts and link them to real-world scenarios. But the thing that Anne was getting at was the reason why linear programming works when you want to figure out what's the best solution given this profit function within the system of constraints is the fact that, would you know it, the maximum value for any function will occur on one of the points of that shape. No matter what the shape is, it's always going to occur on one of the vertices of that shape. Now, the only way for students to prove that with pen, paper, even calculator would be to crunch every solution for any functions they could think of and go, wow, yeah, if I do any point inside there and then try the vertices, it always works out on the vertices. Find me the student who is going to go through that kind of, find me the teacher who is going to go through that kind of labor, find me anyone. It would require a lot of calculations. But with the gizmo, you can make this sort of an inquiry learning activity where the students will try out maybe different scenarios, modeling the feasible regions, and then they go in there with their mouse, and they move the mouse around, and they're going to see right there, and again, I apologize to people in the back, I hope you're not teaching classrooms with 125 kids in them, but you're seeing the value of the function right there in real time. So as they roll their mouse around, they get the automatic readout of the equations. And what they're going to find out is that the maximum value and also the minimum value always occurs on the points. So again, you know, linear programming, a little bit of a heady topic. But the nice thing here that's happening is all of a sudden you have a hands-on interactive exercise that the students can go in and validate a theorem that previously, as Anne said, they had to take on faith. So I'm going to make two arguments here. One is that sort of from a philosophical perspective, we want the kids to go out there and validate mathematical concepts in a hands-on manner and see them. So it's the kind of learners we want to create, not the kind who take things on faith, but the ones who actually know how to validate things using their own brains and hands, and also much more memorable will be my argument, that a kid who's actually walked through the steps understands what it means that the maximum or minimum value always occurs on a vertex rather than just going, yeah, okay, something about a shaded area and something about points. You know, that's all they're going to take away from this. And, you know, you go through a whole math program, you know, from K to 12, and you just get this grab bag of anonymous inert facts that you don't really understand or dimly understand. You're trying to hook them all together. Very difficult without technology like this would be our argument. Anyways, we'll go back to Anne, because hopefully she says it much more coherently than I do. So she says, this gizmo allows the students to move the points around to see maximum minimum occurs at the vertices. My students always respond well to the gizmos. I get a lot of aha moments. And we actually put like the aha concept up on almost the front page of our site, because that's really what gizmos are all about. It's great to see, you know, trying to explain why ocean tides occur, why the, you know, Earth, Moon, Sun system causes that. And you show a kid a dynamic visual model they play with and you see the light bulb go on. I mean, that's why we're in the business for it. And I think that's what really gizmos excel at, is giving you that conceptual understanding that later you can hang the procedural mechanics onto. And I just love this quote. I now do not start planning a lesson without checking Explore Learning to see what gizmos they have on the topic. Thank you. That's what we like to hear. Okay, I think that's it for me. I'll be coming back later if there's time to talk a little bit about the future of what our company is up to, but I'm going to quit out of this. I can leave that set up. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Paul. I'll create a distraction while we change over the microphones. It would be hard for you, even though you could not perhaps see the screen as well, I don't know if you could tell the obvious enthusiasm that Paul has for the gizmos, Emmy award-winning performance perhaps. But now the real Emmy award winner will be up next, Bill Furster, who's going to talk to you about an initiative he's been working on with primary access. And then Terry Levinson will speak to the actual use of that application in the classroom.
Anyway, I want to thank you for inviting us here and to the VTPC, or VPTC, to allow us to show you what we're up to. Let me start the presentation here real quick. Anyway, what we're trying to do is to provide teachers with a way to do a digital historical narratives using primary source documents. One of the issues we had with it is that we had some pioneering teachers. Like, for example, Terry had done a presentation, I think, in her classroom using before primary access, which is why she went to the seminar last summer, and run into a number of issues about it. And we looked at some of the problems. And I had tried a test trial at a school, and having all the advantages to do it, and found it to be a very difficult thing to accomplish. But by the same token, also found some value in the exercise in order to make these things. And I'll show you an example of one in a second. Oops, I guess that's not that one. So one of the issues we're saying here is that what's been going on in social studies education a lot in the last few years is that people are using a lot of primary source documents. And these have become very popular. and a good way for kids to learn perspective. And essentially, it helps them teach besides just facts and you know, names and dates and things like that. It also gives them a sense of historical thinking skills that help ground these other things that are obviously important to SOLs and things like that. And it gives kids a sense of historical perspective and helps them with the evaluation skills and that kind of thing. And essentially what it does is allows kids to act like historians, maybe not in the same sense of an Ed Ayers, but to essentially go through the actions of what it means to do history. So one of the ways people use primary source documents is they'll have kids write things about them. But we're looking at a way to kind of engage kids in a more activity that engages them more in the sense that kids are now, I'm sure you guys have heard this expression, digital natives. You know, they I think a Pew study just said that 50% of the over 50% of the teenagers now actually create their own media, not just to consume it. And so this is another way for people to engage into these primary source documents and make basically these very short digital movies. They're 1 to 3 minutes in length, and they explore a historical question and go through it. And the students narrate these movies in their own voice, and so they're writing. Anyway, let me show you an example of one.
At the onset of the 15th century, Europeans knew very little about the rest of the world. Few Europeans strayed far from their manors or cities. Contact with Asian or African cultures was almost unheard of. No one even knew that North and South America existed. 100 years later, Europeans were exploring all over. They sailed from Europe to India, and that was when Columbus discovered America. What caused Europeans to take an interest in the world around them? One factor that led to European exploration was the influence of Marco Polo. Marco Polo was an Italian explorer who at the age of 17 went to China with his father and his uncle in 1271. He was gone for many years in Asia, living with them and studying their lifestyles, and came back bearing jewels and gold from all over Asia. When he returned, he wrote a book called Descriptions of the World, where he wrote of all the wonderful places he had been to. Another factor to European exploration was Mansa Musa. Mansa Musa was a Muslim emperor of Mali in West Africa. He took a religious pilgrimage to Mecca and brought 60,000 men, 500 slaves, each carrying a staff of gold, and took 80 camels, carrying 4,000 pounds of gold. The Europeans were so interested that they put Mansa Musa on their map, holding a block of gold in one hand. When Europeans heard of all the riches in Africa, they wanted to travel there. A third factor was the Crusades. The Crusades was a battle fought in 1095 in Palestine, in the Middle East, for the Holy Land. Pope Urban II was angry because the Europeans were banned from Palestine by the Muslims. Europe wanted to control Palestine, and Pope Urban said to European lords, if they would fight for him, they would be guaranteed to go to the heaven. When the Europeans saw the exotic goods in Palestine, they wanted the same goods in Europe. Like the Europeans, we wonder what is beyond the world and wonder if it goes on forever.
So anyway, and what it does is we integrate all the functions required to do that in there. So what happens is the teacher goes first and chooses the resources that they're going to use. We partner with a variety of different people, the Smithsonian American Art Museum, the Virginia Center for Digital History, a variety of different DocSouth, and essentially they put together the application. These are the tools. This is, and as Michael alluded to in the beginning, this is a teacher-centered tool. Our goal is to provide, the teacher sets up the activities for the kids to do in the class, either as a whole class activity or individual or working in groups. Then the student looks through the primary source documents, and we've got a lot of ancillary material with each primary source document that gives a date, who is there, why it's important, things like that. And that becomes a critical issue. Then they write their narration. So they sit down, and there's a built-in word processor in it, and they write their script of what they're going to be talking about. And so the other thing, too, is we actually marry the words to the pictures to the words, as opposed to in a traditional nonlinear editor where you're actually using a timeline. And then the kids will narrate it, and narrating in their voice, it lends authenticity to the thing. And then they can basically add motion to it in the same sense that Ken Burns adds motion to his movies. And they end, and they play it, just like we had played it earlier. And I'm going to give a 30-second demonstration of the web app. And this is on our website, and I'll put the link there. And basically, just to show you how simple it is, actually put it in there. This activity is in there. If we wanted to make a... I'm going to sit down for a second here. Essentially, the teacher would have set up what they want the kids to do right here, and then we go in and look through the various resources. So this is on civil rights, so we've got a number of civil rights resources. And I'm just going to do this real quickly because I've only got a few minutes here, and then turn things over to Terry. One of the other things, too, is we've integrated Google Maps in here. Now, this doesn't make much sense for Washington, D.C., but for other kinds of places, and pretty much everybody knows where Washington, D.C. is, but they can click on it and see the terrain. This makes more sense for, you know, the March on Selma or something where kids may or may not know where those places are. So I'm going to add a few more. No civil rights is complete without Rosa Parks. Okay, so now this has a script built into it, and this is essentially a little word processor, right? So this is where the kids do their writing. And essentially what they're going to do now is they're going to drag, we'll start off, I guess, with Brown Board, and then go to Rosa Parks, and then move it over to Martin Luther King. So what we've really done is we've actually made the movie already. So I'm going to play just a snippet of it, and you can see it throws in some moves in there. And so it's very fast to do this kind of a thing. The idea is to remove the friction out of making a movie, because kids don't learn anything by messing with the technology per se. They learn by interacting with the primary source documents and choosing them and writing their script. And so we could go in and in the motion we could, and in this case this might be a more realistic kind of move. And for Rosa Parks, let's start with this guy. Oops. And end up on a close shot of Rosa. And so we're basically setting up the moves. And the motion is not superfluous to the activity, because in a sense the motion, if you look at any of the way that the documentaries of people that use motion in there, like Ken Burns uses it to make a point. For example, if you remember in the Matsumusa one, where they said Matsumusa, they even put him on the map for the gold. We zoomed into the gold to highlight the fact that that was an important part. So it's not just a trick. And then kid narrates it. You'll notice a familiar narrator. So that's the basic idea of it. There's a little nuance here and there, but that's the basic idea. The idea is supposed to be simple. It's all database driven. And I'm going to invite Terry to come up and talk about... do you want me to run it from here and you'll talk up there, Terry?
Sure. That would be great.
So Bill brought a live case study, so we'll have Terry talk about actually using the application in the classroom.
Yeah. Oh, let me just one last thing. The where we're at with it, we've got several ongoing classroom trials. We just finished up one with Terry, and we hope to do another one with Terry in March, right? We've got some in Charlottesville Schools, Buford. And some in the North Carolina schools systems down at Chapel Hill with one of our partners down there, and some in Charlotte. And we're working it with the University of Houston to start piloting it there as well. And you can go to our website here. It's www.primaryaccess.org, which has all the information about it. And you can actually play with the evaluation version that's up there now. So let me turn things over to Terry.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. It's been my extreme pleasure working with Bill and company over the last few months. Like he said, that we became connected over this doing coursework last spring, and I always liked being the guinea pig test subject. So when he needed somebody to volunteer their classroom, I volunteered. Let me say right up front that my technology experience is, or expertise is, fairly limited, although I'm enthusiastic and I am trying to learn more all the time. Mostly my claim to fame is that I have no fear. I jump right in and, you know, just go for it. So I'm always trying to get some other people in to help me do things so that I can learn. And when adults come in to help me learn, I always have three students standing there so they learn it. And because they'll remember it, and I'll probably have to have them reteach me, but then we can teach it a lot of other people in the classroom. So moving along, we decided to do this project, and we discussed what subject we were going to do. We decided, since this was a pilot and we were going to be working out a lot of bugs and so forth, we would do the project on our Civil War review. Civil War is taught in the fourth grade, and they come in, and of course they've forgotten a lot, and so I thought, well, this would be a good thing, a way of using this. So we would be learning this through the use of technology, primary documents, as Bill said, and in cooperative groups. These are 10-year-old students. I teach fifth grade, so these are 10-year-olds. I think I'd like for Bill, go ahead and run the copy of version 2, and then I'll talk a little bit more about how we...
The American Civil War started because the South wanted states' rights and slavery, and the North wanted no slavery and no states' rights, and everybody to be free. The South was agricultural, so they needed slaves to do the work on the plantations. But the North used factories and big industries, so they didn't need the slaves. The South made most of its money by selling cash crops, like tobacco and corn. The North made its money by selling manufactured products. Later in 1816, Abraham Lincoln was elected the 16th president of the U.S. Southern states thought he was a threat to the practice of slavery. Because of this, some states succeeded and called themselves the Confederate States of America. Jefferson Davis became their president.
The Union states were in Fort Sumter, and they were told to leave by the Confederate. But Abraham Lincoln told them not to move, so the Confederate drove the Union out by force. That started the Civil War. 3 days after that, Lincoln called for troops. Virginia refused to send a single soldier. 2 days after that, Virginia voted to secede. Some Western counties did not want to secede. On June 20, 1863, West Virginia became the 35th state in the Union.
On July 21st, the Union and Confederate forces, they fought near a stream called Bull Run. So this battle was called the First Manassas, or the First Battle of Bull Run. Everyone suspected it to be an easy victory, but they were wrong. Thomas Jackson and his troops made a wall and stopped the Union forces. That's where Thomas Jackson got his nickname, Stonewall Jackson.
Was the Confederate's capital. It was Washington, D.C., was the Union capital. It was pretty close together, so the Virginia was the main battlefield during this war. But Richmond was not the Union's only target. They also tried to capture the Shenandoah Valley. That was an important part of the Confederate supplies, such as food and ammo. One day, the Union came in and attacked the Confederate forces at the Shenandoah Valley. They ruined all of their supplies. The Confederates were left with nothing.
While that was happening, a battle was going on at Gettysburg. Many people think of this battle as the turning point of the war for the Union. The Gettysburg battle lasted 4 days. On the last day of Gettysburg, General George Pickett attacked the center of the Union line. This was called Pickett's Charge. After Grant pinned down Lee at Petersburg, Lee fled to Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. Grant went after him, but first went through the Richmond and burned the city. When Grant got to the Appomattox Courthouse, Lee and his soldiers were hungry. and tied. So on April 12, 1865, Robert E. Lee and his troops surrendered to Grant, and that was the end of the war.
If you were listening really closely, there are a couple of errors there. They had to go back and identify those, and we're hoping to re-narrate that portion so that we can use it later. But the process itself was wonderful for the students, and the way we sort of set it up, because it was a pilot, because we knew we would have to, you know, do a lot of problem solving, I had them in groups. One group was the digital movie group. One group was working on Reader's Theater play, and another group, two other groups were working on developing games. And all of this was to review this topic. That meant that I had to do a little managing, and so I called on an office staff person, a parent volunteer, and my principal to come in and help with this project, and they were great. I sort of floated around from group to group, and that was, you know, part of the managerial portion. Bill, you've got the... Okay. For the digital movie group, I gave them daily assignments. And they were sort of charged with the task of presenting the Civil War information to the rest of the fifth grade students using their particular format, digital movie, game, whatever. They were to look at, we had given a pretest and looked at what areas they were extremely weak in, and so I asked them to look at causes of the Civil War and some other factors in particular. And they examined it looking at the topics of geography, economics, people and places, and government. I won't go through every little bit of this, but if you want to move on. Assignment one. So they read through, the groups read through their assignments, all of the assignments, and then they went back and did each one on a daily basis. We did this over a 9-day period, which actually turned out to be 3 months long because of snow days, but it seemed that way. Yeah, right. Absolutely. So 7 days to put it together and 2 days for presentations of all of the work that they had done. The 7 days consisted of about a 40-minute block a day. Students came in, they were so excited about the different projects that they were working on that they would come at lunch every day and work on things during their own time. And I had a couple of students come during after school, and they don't do that when they don't like it, so that's a pretty good indication. They did script planning over a couple, which I think we had allowed not enough time for, and so that was one of the things. They came in on their own time and worked on that as well. But they wrote their script as a group. They divided themselves up. I suggested a way for dividing them up, I teach two social studies groups, so we had one group going in one class and one group, digital movie group, in another, and one group chose to do it the way I had suggested, and the other group did not, and that was fine. We did this as an integrated language arts and social studies and technology project. So they wrote their, they taught each other. They went back and read the material from last year and divided it up among themselves and taught each other the material. Then they worked as a group to come up with a script. then they had to find their digital images to match their script. One day they did recording. After they had put everything on, they did recording in the quiet room, and I took everybody else out of that room, and we worked somewhere else while they did that. And there was a doctoral student in my classroom every day helping with this, which was wonderful, because what we found was that there were lots of glitches and things that needed to be worked out, and the students were great. They did a lot of problem solving, plus they got to hear the adults talking and problem solving, and so I felt like we were also a good model for them. But they did a lot of it as well and offered many, many good suggestions, so that was great. The last 2 days, they presented, all of the groups presented over a 2-day period. We had games that they played. Some of those were, one group did computer games. The other groups did regular board games or Jeopardy games. And then we presented the Reader's Theater and the digital movies. We videotaped the Reader's Theater, and we have the digital movie, and after we do a little more editing and tweaking on the digital movie, then we will use those in the spring to as reviews for SOL testing later on. So, and we presented to over 100 people over the two days. The kids were really excited about that as well. After their presentations, we did a follow-up. I did a follow-up in class. And if you'll scroll down, I think, okay, yeah, that's fine right there. I did a follow-up to discuss with the classes what were the causes of the war, and in the hopes of learning, like, what big ideas that they could take away from this, what connections they could make. You never know how these things are going to work out. So we brainstormed this, and I was hoping to get them to the point of learning the essential understanding of cultural differences can lead to separation, which can promote conflict. If you'll scroll down one more. In the box, they brainstormed. I put it on the board and had one of the students write it down for us so we could print it up. This they came up with: the economy, the differences in the North and the South, and we had discussion about that, slavery, states' rights, the new Western states being formed, and Union preservation. And at the end, I asked, after we got through with the brainstorming, I asked them, what conclusions can you make looking at the brainstorm chart? And I wrote down some of their actual comments. And they were things like, they had opposite views about most things. It's all connected. Yeah, like their views on slavery were because of their economies. Their ideas on states' rights were because of the new states being formed and slavery. It seems like it all has to do with money. Isn't there a saying that money's the root of all evil? Yeah, and also money makes the world go round. They just couldn't solve their problems with money and economy, slavery, and who was going to have control. And all those differences led to war. I was like getting really happy here. And then I asked them, so what big idea can you come up with from those conclusions? And after some discussion, they came up with, too many differences can cause a war, and then sometimes differences cause problems that lead to conflict. And then another student said, Miss L, I don't agree with slavery, but I think the South was kind of like the colonists rebelling against the king. They didn't want to be told what to do and thought the U.S. government was trying to control them, and that's why they broke away. And I'm going, And so after this discussion, the teacher dies and goes to heaven and wishes she had videotaped that session. So anyway, but I did not. So I had given them several sheets to work with as they were doing their planning and so forth to structure that for them a little bit. And they sort of took that and ran with it. There were glitches and errors in the material, and which they had to identify, as I said, and we hope to, you know, be working on that in language arts. It really pointed up, as we were having discussions in class, what they knew and what they did not know, and when they were trying to teach each other and write the script, it became really apparent really fast. And so I could either direct them someplace to find out the information or just, you know, kind of guide their discussion. It gave opportunities for a lot of teachable moments. It allowed the students to engage in problem solving and cooperating as a group. I do have some pictures on there of their presentations. This is a presentation of the an online game that two of my students made up. And they were emailing me at night asking me questions about, you know, why do I have to do this, or can I do this, or how do I get into this? And I was emailing them back. Go ahead. This is the students presenting their digital movie. And parents were there, and they were asking the students questions as well, which was kind of neat. This is one of the Reader's Theater that was going on at the time, and we videotaped that with the digital video camera. And this is one of the regular board games that the students were involved with. I mentioned that we had given pretests to find out what they knew and what we needed to concentrate on. Also, the Reader's Theater that we did sort of also brought in causes of the war. We actually did three causes of the war. Another one was some of the problems during the war, and then one was on end of the war, Appomattox, and so forth. Their pretest for my two classes, there was significant improvement. We gave a post-test as well. Their average score on their pretest was 60%, and their average score on their post-test was 94%, and no score below 80% on their post-test. So I was pretty happy with that. One of the other things that came up, and I don't know if Bill is going to address this later or not, as we were working with this, I kept seeing things that we could use in language arts and not just social studies, and it's my understanding that there might be a language arts version in the works, which I think is great. One of the things, I think they wanted me to quit having ideas because one of the things, it caused more work. One of the things that I saw was on the narration piece, when they were doing the narrative, there was a something for words per minute, and I said, oh, you know, if you could, you know, put an indicator on there. I don't know if you can pull that up. That's okay. If you could put something on there that the kids could actually see, they could register when they record, they could see how fast they're going and whether they need to slow down or speed up, or, you know, they could improve it. We could use that for repeated readings. And then I started talking to the reading specialist in my school about it, and we had some other ideas about adding pictures that could be used for sequencing and comprehension after reading the material. So I think there's a lot of possibilities with primary access. So we just need to keep working.
Thank you. You look at what the 10-year-old digital natives are doing out there in the world, and it's pretty scary for those of us digital immigrants up here on the stage. I've asked Paul Chomsky to just speak quickly to, Terry alluded to sort of the future. The exciting thing about educational technology is that it continues to evolve and grow and challenge both product developers and those who watch the companies that develop the products. And so Paul's going to speak to a product that will be forthcoming from Explore Learning that was a result of a National Science Foundation grant, a two-year grant that Explore Learning was awarded that ends this summer. And it has to do with something that a lot of people are talking about these days in the world of educational technology, and that's assessment. How do we assess using the products that are out there? And so Paul's going to just briefly, very briefly, because then we're going to open it up to some questions, give you a hint of what might be coming in the world of assessment.
Am I back on? Good. Okay, good. Yeah, when Michael called me up to be a part of the panel and asked me to do some closing remarks about the future, I begged off because I have a five-month-old who's the card-carrying member of Colics Anonymous, and so I'm lucky if I'm awake half the time. But so that's why I'm putting up the future question mark here, because I'm not bringing any kind of gospel here about what the future is. But I do want to point, in some ways it was interesting listening to Terry and Bill's presentation in terms of what they were talking about, how we're empowering the teacher. Same thing with the gizmos, that in some parts of the future that I always wanted to be a part of is already here, that it's no longer this idea of one computer, one child, and the child is sort of locked in, turning pages, going from screen to screen, and what's the role of the teacher in all this, and that those kinds of experiments had dubious effectiveness. Now everything that you're hearing is how the tools are empowering the teacher, and that's, I think, already part of like this desirable future that we want to be a part of. So that was really heartwarming. And the other thing that Terry mentioned was this pre-test, post-testing, and how that fits into measuring growth and measuring the impact of these new technologies and the costs that we're paying for them. So the quote that I'm going to use here is from Pearson, which is a very, very large company. Those of you in education probably have heard of Pearson. One of their arms is a testing arm. They do a lot of test instruments that you've probably used. And they have a corporate blog. VPTC actually did a thing on blogging that you may have been here at if you were here for the last luncheon. A blog is basically an online newsletter. So they have one from their assessment arm where their psychometricians make pronouncements about what's coming down the pike in assessment. And so I thought this was interesting. This was in September of last year. They said, "The last revolution in the format of how Americans test students may have been during World War I, when the multiple choice format replaced the essay format as the most prevalent item type in educational testing. And in the decades that followed, all the psychometric techniques about multiple choice questions were developed." So on the one hand, it's a battle-tested technology, almost literally. It's been around for a while, but it isn't exactly revolutionary. So when we launched explorelearning.com in 2003, we were already thinking, okay, what's going to be our next trick, lest we become a one-trick pony? And when we looked at our own product, we saw that we have these rich interactive experiences at the front end that students get to explore and the teachers can use to stimulate discussion and illustrate teaching points. And then when it's time to actually assess the big ideas that they're walking away from with this wonderful educational experience, we give them a bank of multiple choice questions. And I don't want to be part of the people, I don't think this is what the people at Pearson are up to, not to poo-poo multiple choice testing out of hand. It's a very efficient testing device, and like all instructional content, it can be done well or it can be done poorly if you use techniques like asking a why question after you ask them a what question. There's ways to write good multiple choice. But it's limited, especially in the math and science realm. There's a lot of things that we'd like to get at, like knowledge of the scientific method, that's quite cumbersome to get at. And so Pearson's saying, the next revolution in the format of how Americans test students will happen when the computer-delivered simulation replaces the multiple choice format as the most prevalent item type in educational testing. A little pat on Explore Learning's back, because yeah, they're saying this in September 2005, when in 2002 we were writing a proposal to the National Science Foundation to say, hey, we have this interesting idea. We've got these cool gizmos. What if they weren't just tools that people can use to explore concepts, but we could actually use them to start assessing students' conceptual understanding in both math and science? Wouldn't that be neat? Now, for those of you who are familiar with the SBIR program, something that's run by NASA, NSF, NIH, Department of Defense, and so forth, the odds are against you. Don't build your business plan around one of these, because the NSF in itself gets thousands of grant proposals every year. And in tech-rich Virginia, they awarded two in the year that we got ours. So we got one of them. We're looking at 50% of Virginia's SBIR allotment. So we've been working on this now for 2 years. And so the basic concept here is that in addition to using the gizmo to enrich the topic, it's also able to showcase and probe into what the student can demonstrate that they know. So let me give you a little example. So what we're going to see right now is something that looks sort of like a gizmo, The student can create a graph and then watch an animation of what the graph represents. It's a distance-time graph, just like what we were seeing with the mouse and cat before. Well, this one, I guess, is more like the Runaway Bride or something. So you maneuver the graph and you can see things. So this would be sort of an explore part of the exercise. Now, we give them some guided exercises. Why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? And then what we want to do is see, okay, if we give them an animation, that's the red person running up there, can you give me a graph that's the same kind of thing? Okay, let's see. How close am I here? Oh, no. I'm moving a little too far, I think. Okay, let's try that. Okay, now I got it. Okay, so we can generate as many examples as we want. We can solve them if we want a little bit of backup, checks if we have the right answer, and so forth. And then, of course, there's the ubiquitous quiz to check mastery where it's going to generate a couple of examples. Another nice thing about this system is that it's adaptive. So what's happening is if a student, a good sort of local example, we went in to do a math camp at Computers for Kids, a local organization that puts computers into a lot of kids' hands. And we went in there with the purpose of actually teaching a distance time lesson in part so we could field test our technology. And the kids who were there, and this was a fairly small group, broad spectrum of abilities. Like we walked in there and we thought we'd be dealing with kids who had sort of the basic rudiments of graphing down. And we have everybody from a young lady who was really ready for this kind of lesson, in fact, could do basic distance time graphs on her own. You know, all I had to do was run in front of the class and she could graph what I was doing. And then there was another person who couldn't even really put a graph on a point on a graph, not even just reversing XY coordinates, but didn't really get the concept of putting a point on a graph. So this reminded me of what it's like for today's teacher to be in a classroom probably of 20, 30 kids where you have this kind of difference in ability as well. How do you deal with that? Well, one of the ways I think that we can help a teacher deal with that is to give them some exercises that do a little bit of pre-testing to check out where the kids are and then give them exercises at the right level of difficulty. And then as they start learning, it starts ramping up the difficulty, just like any computer game out there. And then if they're having problems, there's all kinds of tools in there. We can say, well, here, for this particular example, here's the solution. Or here's a partial solution. Why don't you adjust the graph to make it a completely correct solution? Or look here, this is where you're going wrong. You know, and you doing that with audio as well as text if somebody's having difficulty reading versus not understanding the mathematical concepts. So this is the kind of thing that I think equips the teacher to deal with some of these problems. Now, one other, look at a gizmo like this. This is part of the sizzle that I think got the National Science Foundation interested in us. Up until now, I've been talking about how it can help you teach sort of your existing teaching points a little bit more effectively and deal with some of the heterogeneity that you're seeing in the classroom. Imagine something like this, which is our gizmo for seed germination. It's meant for the science classroom. It allows a student to use the sliders down there to control the amount of water, the amount of light, and the temperature in the herbarium where the seeds are germinating. And students get to see the effect that has on the number of seeds that germinate. In most states, there's a little standard that says, student will understand and be able to apply the scientific method. A little bit difficult to test using a multiple choice exam. And if you want to do that through some kind of hands-on lab activity that you're going to grade, it's a lot of time, oftentimes a lot of expense, unwieldy. Not the kind of thing that states, they're in fact pulling away from this a little bit. But if you had a gizmo here where you could check, does the student understand that they have to systematically vary one value at a time while keeping the others constant? Do they understand that they have to do repeated trials with the same variables to make sure that they're not interpreting noise in the data, but that they're averaging their results? Do they understand how to read a graph? Do they understand how to make a graph? All of those things. If it could automatically be assessing what the students know, this is a valuable thing. I'm not saying by any means that this should get rid of high school lab experiences, but in terms of economically, I mean in terms of time and material cost, getting you a better picture of where students are in their understanding of the scientific method, I think that's invaluable. And one thing, another way that I feel like we're already partially into the future of educational technology is what you're seeing of their collaborations between teachers and the developers of the tool. It's the only way to get usable technology, and we do the same kind of thing. And it was when we were in an NRICO classroom watching a teacher use Gizmo on fractions. She had the kids going through the exploration guide, which is a little bit piece of curriculum that we give with every gizmo. They're sort of working on their own at different parts in the guide, and she comes over to me, and I'm standing in the back of the classroom trying to be inconspicuous, and she says, you know what I would love? I would love it if my desk was back here, because you see right now I can pretty much sort of see everybody's screen, and it gives me a better insight into where they are. And in terms of classroom management, so that right now I'm sort of the roving tutor. I need to know who's the, where should I be next, and why are they having a problem? And if I have to go over there and sort of, you know, grok what they're up to and ask questions, it takes me time, and it limits the effectiveness that I can have. So back to the lab we go, and we think to ourselves, you know what the teacher needs? We've already gotten to the point where you don't have to wait for tests to go off to some center and get them analyzed and come back. And, you know, by the time you figure out that your kids are having problems with one specific teaching point, that was 3 months ago. Well, we're past that. Now, you know, most tools can give you reporting at the end of some kind of a post-test or so forth. But what if you had real-time radar where literally you have a separate application on your desktop that in real time is telling you what students are up to? Oh, Billy hasn't actually done anything for 5 minutes. He's surfing the internet. And over there, Sally has just gone through three levels of help. And he's still struggling. We suspect her problem is this. She's reversing XY coordinates. Very simple to remediate, but go over there and give her a hand. You know, like, it's not changing, it's substituting itself for you as a teacher, but it is empowering you with whatever it can find out to help you do your job more effectively. So that's another part of the technology that we're working on, and Michael just gave me the sign, so that's the...
Thanks, Paul.
That's what we're working on.
We do want to honor our commitment to end promptly at 1:30, so that means we'll have time for maybe one or two questions. Just a couple of closing remarks. Listening to the panel discussion and their obvious enthusiasm for what they do, I began by speaking about a premise of what probably the best technology in the classroom is. I heard two other sort of interesting side effects or attributes. One is sort of the soft side benefits of the product. You know, we're talking about getting students to work collaboratively in teams and to do problem solving and critical thinking and decision making. Not just learning about the content, but also these real world experiences that once they get out of the classroom, that's what life's all about, really. And also bringing to the students a sort of sense of joy about their schoolwork. I think that's a great side effect of the best of the educational software that's out there. So we're going to take a couple of questions. My charming assistant, Tracy Linkus, who is the communications chairman for the VPTC, will bring a microphone to you. We are going to have a couple of housekeeping matters at the end, so don't rush out, including a drawing, as I understand, for a free something. And copies of the presentations, we will put copies of the presentations on the website, the vptc.org website, so be sure to check there for that. And the podcast of this panel will also be available on the website as well. So don't rush off if you can stay, but we will one or two questions if there are any out there.
What's the cost of all these wonderful things?
Ours is provided actually no charge. We're a non-commercial venture.
Yeah, I mean, I can, as far as there is a cost, obviously, to be used, using software in the classrooms. You know, you pay for textbooks, you're going to pay for educational software. I think that the philosophy of pricing, at least that Explore Learning used, was to try to rationalize the cost against any of the other sorts of supplemental, either hard copy materials or soft copy materials that you could get, and price it on a pretty reasonable per student basis for an annual subscription. But if you do, if you want to know the actual cost, go to the ExploreLearning.com website, and you can have a sales rep contact you.
I have a question for the classroom teacher. How long did it take your group that made the movie? How many class periods?
We worked on that. I think we worked on it 8 class periods, and then we spent 2 days on presentations. But our class periods, each one was about 40 minutes long.
Maybe one more question here in the front.
This is a question about gizmos. Are there any plans at all to develop these for primary grades? When will we see that?
We're targeted primarily at 6 through 12, although we've seen usage in the elementary schools and also in higher ed, because we have some that are things like elapsed time, you know, like how to read an analog clock and fractions. Probability, a lot of those standards are starting to creep into the elementary schools. So already you'll find there's a search tool on the site. If you know you put in probability or whatever it is that you're looking at, you'll find some gizmos already that will address the topics. It's definitely something that we're looking into right now. Rather, we're not concentrating on going up. We're concentrating on going down in grade level. So but even in 2006, I think you'll see some examples like that. There's still a little bit of work to be done within the middle school, high school, sort of broadening our coverage, but that'll be our next thing. And the technology that I'm showing that's sponsored by the National Science Foundation, it's sort of a new way of building them, and it's really, really good at the things that are covered in an elementary curriculum. So from that project, in terms of assessment, I think you'll see more things at early middle school, late elementary, than you will in high school at first. So that's the direction we're heading.
Again, thank you very much, and I'll now turn it back over to Gary Henry.
Thanks, Michael. I know that there was a lot of interest to this particular event, and so I'd like to take kind of an ad hoc survey by a show of hands of how many people might be interested in a more expansive forum to talk about this topic at a future date. Okay, that's a pretty good number. So with that kind of interest, those of you who are not already on the VPTC's distribution list, if you wouldn't mind checking the website to contact us to get added, we'll keep you informed about the upcoming events. And I want to thank Sean Tubbs, who's going to do the podcasting of this event for us, so all of you will have an opportunity to refer your colleagues to it if that would be appropriate. And you can find the podcast on cvillepodcast.com as well. Now, our next event is going to be February 7th, also here at the Omni, on a common vision and a call to action for our community. And last, I want to thank Michael and the panel for taking their time to put on this presentation today, and we have a small token from the VPTC of thanks for each of them. Thank you very much.
This has been the Virginia Piedmont Technology Council's January Luncheon, Beyond the Book, Using Technology to Enhance K-12 Learning. The next VPTC Luncheon will be on February 7th. Here's the blurb. As the Greater Charlottesville region transforms from a 20th century economy to a 21st century knowledge-based economy, our community will be faced with both obstacles and opportunities. VPTC, along with the Thomas Jefferson Partnership for Economic Development, will co-host for the third consecutive year a panel luncheon to discuss how technology-driven businesses will impact economic development and the future of Central Virginia. You can register online at www.vptc.org. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Thanks for listening.